The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. We've had some very popular public broadcasters go into exile, names like Garrison Keillor, Charlie Rose. And another one who did a few years ago is a guy named Bob Garfield. We used to hear him on the radio all the time on public radio. He apparently shouted at some people in a meeting, it's been alleged. And he did this at the public radio station in New York City. And that was it. Well, now we live in a time when you can be the head of the Department of Defense and have allegations and still get the job. You can even be president of the United States and have allegations and still get the job. So in these new times, I'm going to bring you an interview I did with Bob Garfield, who is very funny. And I loved talking to him back in 2003 when he put out a book called Now a Few Words from Me, Advertising's Leading Critic Lays Down the Law Once and For All. We call it the Best of the Book Nook.
And the book is called, And Now a Few Words from Me, Advertising's Leading Critic Lays Down the Law Once and For All. How did you become advertising's leading critic?
Basically, I'm also advertising's, last critic. Because it's not a large category of enterprise advertising criticism. It's not like there's an association of advertising critics, large membership organization. It's basically me and this one other woman who's a very talented writer named Barbara Lippert, who writes for our competitor Ad Week magazine. It's pretty much Barbara and me. And how you get to be the leading advertising critic? Well, you choose the leading advertising trade magazine and get them to give you a column there. And all of a sudden, with hardly any effort, you're the leading critic. And then I guess you do it for 17 years and take the exercise very seriously, even though you try to crack jokes in all your columns. It's an amazing thing because it's a little column in a little trade magazine, but it is actually kind of an institution in the industry all around the world.
I really enjoyed this new book, but after reading it, I realized it wasn't written for me.
No, it really wasn't written for you. It was written for people in the industry. However, because everybody is at home an advertising critic, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, you tell me what you thought, but it's not that you weren't able to follow the things that I was describing, and I imagine the problems that I encounter again and again in advertising were resonant for you as an advertising consumer as much as they would be for the clowns whose behavior I'm trying to change within the industry itself. This is written as a business book for business people, but I think it crosses over. I hope it does, because otherwise I've been wasting a lot of time talking to pretty much every radio audience in North America. But Vic, lest you think that I'm somehow dissing you, and I just want to share with your audience that my last conversation with Vic was the single best broadcast interview that I've ever been involved in from this side of the microphone, and I've done, I don't know, hundreds if not thousands. So I rushed back to Yellow Springs to do this. And by the way, nearly at the cost of my life, I came in through that thunderstorm last night, and I want to tell you, that was a white-knuckle job. There were moments there where I was wondering what the headline would look like and whether, my name would be in it or not.
I can see it now on the cover of the National Enquirer. Advertising's leading critic takes a fall in Dayton. Bob Garfield joins us. The book has now a few words from me. Why did God invent the mute button? Because she also invented commercials? Is that how it goes?
Yeah, I think that's the yeah. Joke. Listen, I'm going to tell you about God in advertising. This book presupposes that God has a lot on his plate, or as you say, her plate. And while would love to hand down a bunch of laws regarding marketing communications, just is a little tied up. And you don't get to be the supreme being without learning how to delegate. This is where I come in. I have presented myself as a prophet of advertising worldwide. And I decided to write what amounts to the Ten Commandments of advertising. So all the people dressed all in black all over the world who are foisting off all these advertrocities on us that you are hitting your mute button to avoid. So that doesn't have to happen. And that's what the book is for. That said, I don't hate advertising. You know, I don't, unlike many people, probably most of your listeners, I don't think it's a sinister force. I think on balance, for all of the problems that I do have with advertising, on balance, I think it's been a positive force, certainly in the economy and, you know, maybe even the culture. It does not, repeat, does not make people want to buy things they neither want nor need. And if it does do it once, it never does it twice. I don't think it's the cause of our grossly acquisitive society and our poor, skewed value systems. It exploits it. It's not the cause of it. It is not the cause of sexism and objectification. It perpetuates them. It's not the cause of it. We have some problems in our society, in our culture, and in our economy, and in our environment that advertising doesn't necessarily solve, but is not the cause of. And on the contrary, what it has done is underwritten the media revolution. And it is most everything that we treasure in the media has been brought to you by Madge. And, you know, that's not nothing. And when it is done properly, it also conveys information that consumers want to have and need to have. So I think when done right, that is to say my way, advertising can be a positive force in our lives. And you know, the programming situation is so bleak now that the cliche is that the advertising is actually better than the programming, and often enough, at least in terms of entertainment value, that's true. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean the best advertising is stuff that makes us laugh and talk about over the water cooler, but nonetheless, if you watch a lot of TV, you probably have as many memorable moments from the ads as you do from the programming itself.
My guest is Bob Garfield. The book is And Now a Few Words from Me. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. The irony of the fact that this is non-commercial radio and we're about ready to talk about commercials, it didn't escape me. Your book is so funny. I read it over the weekend, and people kept wondering, what are you laughing about? I kept laughing and laughing and laughing. I couldn't control myself. You're hilarious, and I love...
Well, I will fix those spelling errors for the second edition, Vic. I promise.
I loved your discussion of commercials, some of which I'd never seen, but you give us a really great idea of what the commercial's about. And some in particular I'd like to talk about. This Nintendo commercial, I've never seen this one. This one that got you so upset.
Yeah, you know, look, there's a lot of terrible commercials out there, and there's commercials out there that make me angry for a whole host of reasons, and I mean really angry, because let's face it, advertising, where almost wherever it appears, is an uninvited guest, and I believe it has not only the responsibility for decorum, it has a special responsibility for decorum. There's some things you wouldn't go into public to do. You wouldn't knock onto somebody's door and barge in their living room and do a certain array of things that we can all think of. Why in God's name would you do it in a television commercial? And one of the things I would never do is take young people, let's say 14-year-old boys, who are at a very delicate stage of their maturity, who are filled with the adolescent angst and anger and questioning and militancy, and you advertise to them to take their Nintendos and put on their Mortal Kombat or whatever video game up, crank it really loud, and to make adults angry, to actually pour gasoline on the fire of teenage insecurity, and then to tell them, as this commercial did, that life is meaningless. It told kids to hawk a loogie at life, and it showed the kid, you know, coughing up a sputum sample and letting it fly. And I just thought that was the most egregious breach of the compact between the advertiser and the viewer, to do something so aggressive for an audience that is so vulnerable. Because let's start with this, life is not meaningless, and to tell kids against the backdrop of teen suicide, just for example, in the name of selling a couple of, you know, video games, it's just a perversity. And while maybe not the worst ad that I've seen in technical terms, certainly among the most repugnant examples of advertising I have ever seen.
There's one ad that you tried to stop. I think it only ran once during the Super Bowl. It's the one a shoe company did that had a tie-in with the Humvee.
Yeah, yeah. There are two ads. I mean, I don't know how many thousands of ads that I've reviewed over the years, but there were two of them where I usually see them before they break. So I saw this one on the Friday before the Super Bowl, which 100 million people watch. And I got on the phone to the agency, and I said, are you going to show this commercial? Oh, yeah, yeah, we think it's very humorous. Yeah, don't. Do something else. Run dead air. Do not put this on television. Oh, no, we think it's very amusing. We think it's going to – don't do it. Well, they did it. And here was the commercial. Five mercenaries in a khaki uniforms in a military-style Humvee tracking a runner on the Kenyan veldt and tracking him like an animal, eventually catching up to him, drugging him, rendering him unconscious. By the way, they're white. He's black. Rendering him unconscious, and then while he is unconscious, against his will and in contravention of centuries, if not millennia of Kenyan tradition, put a pair of shoes on him. Unbelievable. I mean, it was so neo-colonialist, so racist, basically, that I simply couldn't believe they did. Well, okay, so they ran it. What happened next? The chairman of the company had to apologize to the world because 100 million people have 200 million eyeballs, and they large numbers of them were aghast. And can an eyeball be aghast? Perhaps I was careless with my metaphor. In any event, and eventually the company went, which is in bankruptcy now, went on to sue the advertising agency in the only case that I know of for malpractice, for persuading them to put that on TV. I just wanted to say I'm momentarily distracted because I'm sitting here in the WYSO studios at what looks like one of those semicircular kitchen counters in a very fancy kitchen. And I'm sitting down, and Vic is about 10 feet away from me standing, because Vic likes to stand when he works. And his legs were slightly spread, and behind him is a piece of electronics with one of these LED lights. And there was basically a laser pointing at me from Vic's groin, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a very distracting thing to try to answer a perfectly intelligent question while someone is groin lasering you from a range of only 10 feet. So if I seem a little bit, off my feed, that is why. Okay, now, what was the question?
Truth in Advertising.
Yeah, First Union. Everyone who ever did a bank commercial from 1961 on did research, consumer research, and discovered, lo and behold, that people don't like banks. They're impersonal. They keep ridiculous lobby hours. They treat you like you're a number. When you want something from them, like a loan, they turn you down flat, blah, 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 blah. But they want your deposit. So everyone from 1962 on did advertising that told the same lie. We're the friendly bank. We care about you. Well, it's ridiculous. So credit the people at First Union who decided that they weren't going to just get out there and tell the same old lie. What they presented instead was hyper-truth. They did this kind of Carnival Midway, very, very gothic imagery of grotesque people in very garish situations. And they talked about, described the financial landscape as a really, really scary place. And then looming in the distance is this gigantic, monolithic bank that's going to come rescue you. And it's like their tagline was something like, come to the mountain or let the mountain come to you. And you're sitting there in the TV audience, you're going like, no, don't stay there. Stay there, because it's the most frightening, scary, grotesque thing. I mean, it's like you get nightmares to watch this. It was very much Tim Burton, Batman cinemagraphic execution, and just terribly troubling. So, credit them for admitting that First Union was, in fact, a gigantic monolith that didn't care about you, but it's not the kind of truth that advertisers typically should be sharing. I mean, it's best just kind of left alone. Here's what happened. Campaign was on for less than a year. First Union shares were selling at 70. They ended up selling at 36. I forget the exact arithmetic, but I do know that depending on how you do the math, the campaign cost the advertiser, in terms of its market capitalization, $30 billion. So, yeah, that was a failure.
So if I'm hearing you, Bob, you're saying if people do really stupid things, they end up having to pay a high price?
Yeah, or not. Because the other thing is about advertising is, look, Vic, good advertising works. Uh-huh. Bad advertising works. I mean, advertising, national advertising, fundamentally works. It does some certain minimum things. When you go into the supermarket and you see a brand and you don't recognize it, you're probably less likely to buy that brand. If you do recognize it, you make certain assumptions that the company is going to still be in business tomorrow, that if you don't like the product, you'll get your money back or something, some such thing. It confers an image of substance and durability, and you presume, at least as a consumer, that this product is approximately equivalent, if not better, than anything else in the same category. That's what national advertising does, even when it's pretty terrible. Now, if it's genuinely awful, when it's a true advertrosity, it can harm a brand and harm the society, can harm the public at large by being dishonest, by being offensive, assaultive, indecent. And on the top end, advertising like Just Do It for Nike, for example, or 1984 for Macintosh, or God Help Us All, the Marlboro Cowboy, they can do remarkable things on the other end and actually become part and parcel of the value of the brand and create great fortunes. So, but by and large, considering that probably 95% is neither very, very good or very, very bad, what I do for a living is completely irrelevant. Because it all performs about the same in the marketplace.
Well, Bob, I'm sorry. I try to be relevant. The book is, and now a few words from me. And I have just one word, Bob. Sex. Let's talk about sex.
Okay, let's talk about sex. Sex is a basic human drive. You know, right up there with, hiding things from your mom. And clinical psychologists have demonstrated that it is on our minds all the time. I don't have the exact statistics at my fingertips, but I believe that people from their 30s below, men think of sex every 5 seconds, women think of sex every 7 seconds. Battered down by age and experience, people in their 40s don't think about sex but every 10 seconds. In other words, it's a preoccupation. And therefore, is not necessarily the wrong way for getting the audience's attention or to try to get your message to resonate with them. But there are some product sales that simply sex is an irrelevancy. And it, like so many other aspects of advertising, where either the joke, the humor is irrelevant to the brand, the celebrity that they've cast is irrelevant to the brand and its meaning to the consumer, the special effects that they've used is irrelevant to the message. So often sex or whatever sexual attention getter they use has absolutely nothing to do with the brand or the product being sold. So why? Well, you know, what's the advantage? And then on top of the problem with just sex as a general subject area, sex leads inevitably to sexism and objectification of women, and which has been truly destructive to the culture. And advertising didn't invent it, but it certainly perpetuates it. And while there was a brief moratorium in the mid-90s to the gross, blatant objectification in beer advertising and elsewhere, it has certainly come back with a vengeance. And it's just not right. I live in the real world. I am a man. You know, I have genitals. I have certain base primal responses to things. But, you know, the definition of civilization is to overcome your primal instincts and your baser instincts for the purposes of everybody living together in peace and harmony. That's what civilization is. And advertisers should kind of internalize that. And not treat women like a pair of breasts with a marginal actress attached to them.
And there you have it, Bob Garfield. He did slip the word beer in there, because I think when we think of sexy commercials, beer is definitely in there. And I didn't realize that Anheuser-Busch had done this moratorium thing until I read your book. I had no idea. And, of course, now where is it?
Yeah, well, it's like forget about it. Now, I must say, of all of the major beer advertisers, Anheuser-Busch has been the most decorous. Coors is out there selling the Twins fantasy and Miller Lite's idea of advertising because they are in just such abject desperation as a brand that has been so mismanaged over the last 12 years. Now they are reduced to showing implied lesbian catfights between women with enormous boobs. I mean, that's the marketing of Miller Lite. Look at these big busted women claw each other in wet cement. Buy Miller Lite. Look, it's not nobody's going to buy Miller Lite because of that, and it's going to harm their brand in the long run, and they're going to disenfranchise most of their women in their audience and a lot of men, and it's just an act of just absolute cynicism, and it's going to fail anyway, but that's where we are. The culture has really coarsened, advertising no less than anywhere else. And what would have been unthinkable 10 years ago is now routine now, both in South Park and TV and in beer ads. And the difference is there is a selection process on editorial content, on programming, on literature, on whatever else you encounter in the media landscape. There is a selection process involved. There is no selection process in advertising, and it cannot, must not behave as coarsely as the rest of the pop culture, because when it does, it is disrespecting the sensibilities of vast numbers of people in the audience. Even if they're not in the target audience, they're in the audience nonetheless. And the Miller catfight commercials, right at the top of the list of advertising that simply has forgotten all about the golden rule and is all about fulfilling the primeval fantasies of a small segment of the target audience.
What's this about you being kidnapped?
I think I really meant primal. I didn't mean primeval. I said primeval. But the word I was grasping for so unsuccessfully was primal fantasies. Kidnapped. Yeah, I went to give a speech in the Virgin Islands a number of years ago, and guys tried to kidnap me with guns and stocking masks and escaped by a miracle.
Who'd they think you were?
I don't. Truthfully, this is actually not a subject I love to discuss.
Oh, okay.
It was. I don't think it was a kidnap for ransom. I think it was something far worse. At least the FBI thought so. It was a very nasty affair. It may have been for ransom, but.
Well, you alluded to it in the book, so I thought maybe it was fair game, you know.
And no, it's fair game. I just it was a chapter in my life that was so unpleasant, as you can imagine, an attempted kidnapping would be, and it triggered a very profound depression, and which had ramifications elsewhere in my life. That let's talk about something.
Okay, let's talk about. The unpleasant advertising that was connected to national tragedy.
Yeah, this is one of my big hobby horses, and I'm going to get aboard and ride like the wind. There are some things advertisers like to connect with the audience. There are certain times in the life of a nation where it's not difficult to connect with an audience. And there is a temptation to do so even when it's best just to keep your mouth shut. One such episode, the quintessential such episode, was 9/11. A great tragedy occurred that was felt around the world. So many people, powerless to act, comforted themselves by just saying things. Sometimes they were banal, sometimes they were a little stupid, obvious. Sometimes it was just flag-waving patriotism. Sometimes it was just condolences. And many of us did it. And it's natural because you're powerless, and just what do you do? What do you say? So you just kind of blather. Like when you're meeting someone whose mom just died, and sometimes, you know, a lot of people who just simply don't know what to say, and they often end up saying the wrong thing. Advertisers did that to a fairly well. And I mean, some of it was amusing. My particular favorite was a sign outside of a bait shop in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, that said, "God bless America, fresh mullet." and others, other national advertisers weighed in. Anheuser-Busch did it with a somewhat sentimental, but nonetheless poignant and I think sufficiently respectful scene of the Clydesdales bowing, kneeling before the hallowed grounds of where the World Trade Center Twin Towers once stood. But other advertisers did things that were simply beyond the pale. And I would say the most egregious example would be General Motors Corporation, which mounted, according to the president's suggestion, what I call the 3,000 dead fall celebration. And they gave zero interest financing. And they told the world, or told America, that it needed to go out and buy a Pontiac because it's the patriotic thing to do at a time like this. No. I'm sorry, that's simply not right. The response to this tragedy was not to go out and get a Lumina or a Pontiac or whatever else. At this time of year, General Motors was going to have a zero interest or low interest financing option anyway, because that's how the cycle works. And you get to the late fall and they start giving them away. But to connect it with the tragedy was just simply repulsive. It was repulsive and such an insult to the real grief and the real condolences and the real heartbreak and the real ramifications of international terrorism and the pain and the suffering of the victims and the society as a whole, that I just thought it was one of the great obscenities in the history of commerce. And then Ford did it too.
Bob Garfield, and now a few words from him, from me, from him. I'm confused.
It's from one of us. If they buy the book, I don't care who it's from.
Well, Bob, let's not wait 7 years for the next. When was the last book? Was that 96?
I think it was 96. Gosh, how the time flies.
Yeah, write another book. Write a book sooner next time, okay? Because I really love having you on the program.
Well, thank you, Vic. I love being here. But I have to tell you, you know, you write a single column. It takes you 3 hours. 100 times, maybe 1,000 times more people read a single column that you've sweated over for, you know, half an afternoon, than will read a book that you have worked on for a year and a half. And you begin to wonder, why do you do it? Well, because mom is happy, because if the table and the porch, if the leg ever is too short and you need to shim it, then you have hundreds of books around that you can do the trick. I don't know why authors do what they do, because most not for riches, because there are no riches attached to it, but here it is. And I hope the advertising world appreciates it, because gosh, writing books is labor intensive.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. That was Bob Garfield, recorded 22 years ago, talking about a book that he had out then. And he was our leading advertising critic. And also a very well-known voice. I'm sure if you've listened to public radio for a number of years, you remember his work. And you don't hear much from him anymore. But he is also 70 years old, so hopefully he's happily retired somewhere. A very entertaining man. I hope you enjoyed that. That was my second and final interview with Bob Garfield, going back to 2003. And it was during a membership campaign, which we have coming up here on WYSO very soon. Thanks for listening to your public radio station.